have to turn this on. The three engines are, one, geographic regionalism, product of the 15th and 16th century long march to the south. You have a map of this. This is akin, I guess, some people would say, to the American Western movement, westward movement in the 19th century. It produced in Vietnam a strong sense of regional identification of north, center, south, which is characterized, as regionalism is everywhere, by stereotypes and self-images. Second heritage is political clandestinism. Vietnamese have a great ethno-linguistic unity. They're divided by region, class, clans, associations, and politics. Clandestinism is a device by which they dealt with foreigners. Chinese for 1,000 years, French through the colonial era. It's now a style of politics practiced by the Viet Cue in the United States. Political clandestinism is characterized chiefly by covert social organizations and conspiratorial and secret politics. Third heritage is what I call socio-political malaise. That's not a very good term, and I can't think of one that's better. I'll explain it later. It essentially means social problems that stem from these first two heritages. All right, starting with the first of the foundations of Vietnamese history, traditionalism. Sociologists and anthropologists normally, or others, nominally classify societies into three types: traditional, transitional, and modern. Traditional, and modern. What distinguishes them, one from another, is the people's view of the world, and specifically their view of change and the nature of change. It's an attitudinal thing. Traditional people do not see the world as under their control, do not see that they can cause things to happen or not happen, or they have no system for doing this. Once an awareness of causation takes place, the society then becomes transitional and later modern. And many experts or authorities, such as Daniel Lerner, my mentor at MIT, believe that this transformation basically was a function of the communication of ideas, communication process. He wrote a very important book called The Passing of the Traditional Society. Daniel Lerner. This is about Iran, in which he, I guess I could say a bit about it, he and his team went into Iranian villages, which were very traditional, and they showed motion pictures to them. He was testing a thesis that if you show a person a motion picture who's never seen a motion picture before, you change their lives forever in a way you're not too sure about, but which is very real. And he showed them a number of movies, and tested their movies, one movie about many of the scenes in upscale New York, in an apartment building, very sophisticated. They had hardly ever seen a tall building before. And very complicated results from this, but he was convinced that, as I was when I went to Vietnam in 1960, that the communication process is what this transformation involves and it's all about. At the start of the Vietnam War, Vietnam was a traditional society, deceptively so. 80% of the people lived in villages in the manner that we discussed in last week's description of village life. The struggle, political struggle and social struggle in those days, the late 1950s, was localized. It was the South Vietnamese government, the GVM, against the newly formed Viet Cong and other nationalist organizations. Both sides sought to bring change to the village, to move the villagers out of their traditional mold. It was, therefore, basically an organizational struggle. If you want a long discussion of this, see my book, Viet Cong, which is about the National Liberation Front and this struggle between the two sides, in which I argue that from the start it was more or less tacitly agreed by the GVN and the Viet Cong that this was a struggle of organizations in which each side had certain advantages, certain liabilities, but that in the end victory would go to the side that could get the best organized, to stay the best organized, and out-organize or disorganize the other side. I discuss this struggle in detail in lectures 15 and 16. Suffice to say here that the struggle was over how best to transform Vietnam from a traditional society to a transitional society to a modern society. Now to China, history, and the Vietnam War. The world looks at China. What it sees as an essential characteristic, it universally and incorrectly labels ethnic imperialism. A better word for this, or an awkward one, is Chineseness. You can go anywhere in the world, to Brazil or Israel or Denmark, and you speak of Chineseness. And at once your listener there will know what you mean. They'll agree that there is a transcendental sense of things Chinese. Not just Chinese as another nation or culture, but China is a world, complete, self-contained, like a planet. There are similar labels such as Frenchness or Americanness, but compared to Chineseness, they differ not in degree but in kind. Encountering China by any foreigner, but especially I would say a Westerner, can be a very disturbing experience. Even the casual foreigner, if it's all sensitive, is swept up by the magnetic colossal force of China, one that defies time and is beyond ideology. You stand in awe of the reach of Chinese history. Chinese gentlemen aired their caged nightingales who were trained to sing in three-part harmony while carrying them through delicately formal gardens at a time when my ancestors were still painting themselves blue. One is astounded by the energy and the breadth of Chinese accomplishment, art, artifact, cuisine, especially cuisine. You stand dwarfed before the spirit of China, as timeless, as unchanging, as the growing of rice, and as uncertain. As a rational modern, one is chagrined by the realization that slowly grows that the Chinese long ago encountered most of man's personal and social problems. In centuries of pragmatic experimentation, they perfected the ability to smooth over the burrs of contact when human meets human. In act to soften human relations, the Chinese have no peer anywhere when they want to exercise it. But this is also a source of trouble for the Chinese, especially for its closer neighbors such as Vietnam, because it has left the Chinese with an implacable worldview, the conviction that China is different and therefore superior. This superiority means, among other things, China's inherent right to act as the monitor of heaven and to supervise the destinies of the peoples living on the edge of the Middle Kingdom, that is, in China. Heaven, hell, and the Middle Kingdom in between, China. And this means for the Rimland barbarians who are so located, and that includes all of us, who are not Chinese, an obligation of deference. But in this age of ultra-nationalism, that sort of claim does not go down well with China's neighbors, in this case the Vietnamese, among whom are the most nationalistic-minded of any peoples. All this is poorly understood outside of China. Indeed, that is China's is probably the most misunderstood country in the world. It's a condition which should be repaired, but it's essentially, I'm afraid, up to the Chinese to do this. Historic Vietnamese and Chinese relations always have been marked by great antipathy, certainly on the part of the Vietnamese. We have been invaded by the French once, the Americans once, but 17 times by the Chinese. And my historians love to tell visitors. But it seems clear to me that this is not simple ethnic antipathy at work. It's far more complex. Much closer, I should say, to the modern psychological love-hate concept, which psychiatrists often encounter in husband-wife relations. Not true, I would argue, that the Vietnamese simply hate the Chinese. They admire China greatly, have borrowed heavily from them over the centuries in religion, art, government, architecture, and so on. So they find in themselves much that is, in effect, Chinese. But the Vietnamese also fear China. It's natural human nature that you automatically hate something that you fear. This is often denied by the Vietnamese. I was in Hanoi a couple of years ago. I met with General Chop, the famous North Vietnamese general. A long interview or meeting in which he kept stiffing me with bringing down the, well, with every question I would ask, he'd somehow turn it around when are you Americans going to give us the most favored nation status? And at one point, I thought, if he brings that up once more, I'm going to ask him, what did you people think you were doing when you invaded Cambodia? But it never came up again. But anyway, at one point I said, what about China, General? What do you think about, oh, China, we don't worry about China. China is no problem. It's a non-problem. I said, really? That's not what I hear around Hanoi. It's not what I hear from other Vietnamese officials. He said, who said that this is not true? And I wanted to say, well, the foreign minister, for openers, yesterday, he said this, but I didn't want to get the poor guy in trouble, because the day before I asked the foreign minister, what about China? And he said, oh, China, we have worried about the Chinese for 1,000 years, and we'll worry about them for another 1,000. And I thought that's a very good diplomatic answer, coming from a diplomat. It would go down well in China. They would love to hear that. Also, it was a very accurate answer. It's about the only honest answer you could give. Chinese are very hard to read as to what they're going to do, and their geniuses are doing what you don't expect. even fool themselves in this. At any rate, Vietnam's association with China is complex. It stretches far back into history. As the Vietnamese version of this has it, this began 500 BC, when living in China, south of the Yangtze River, were the 100-year, Y-E-U, 100 tribes. And one by one, these 100 tribes were assimilated by the Han Chinese coming down from the north, all except the Nam Viets, or the South Viets, who fled southward to the Red River Delta, determined to resist this pressure for Sinoization of Han Hoa. There's a number of literary examples of this. I won't bother quoting them to you. Anyway, the Nam Viets then fled southward into what is now northern Vietnam. But the sons of Han pursued them, and by 258 BC, the Red River Delta had come under Chinese control. By most accounts, the Chinese rule was not particularly oppressive. And in the long run, I think you could say it proved far more beneficial for the Nam Viets than for their overlords. For it permitted the Vietnamese to appropriate virtually in toto an entire civilization, culture, architecture, art, literature, religion, educational and legal systems. What the Chinese got for their trouble was constant low-grade resistance, punctuated by rebellions and village-level disturbances that required what were called pacification efforts. Vietnamese history and legend are filled with accounts of these heroic anti-Chinese Vosges. For example, the famous Chung sisters, Iba Chung, who went forth on battle elephants, this is about the time of Christ, went forth on battle elephants leading an army against an infinitely superior Chinese force. When defeated, they drowned themselves in a lake in Hanoi that even today is venerated by a mystic cult. The tradition was that every Vietnamese was a soldier, and when the call came, he would drop his hoe and march off to battle the Chinese. The Vietnamese see themselves in history, in this respect and otherwise, as being defensively martial. Although their reputation among their neighbors, particularly in the Indochina Peninsula, is a reputation for being aggressively martial. With respect to China, particularly, this sense of this ancient Vietnamese martial spirit is a manifestation of behavior in response to cruel aggression, what's called the just cause, or Chim Nghĩa. Connotes a highly moral act, ridding in rationality, compassion, and responsibility. North Vietnamese, to a very large extent, viewed the Vietnam War as Chim Nghĩa, a just cause, highly moral, rooted in rationality, compassionate, and responsible. These attitudes toward the Vietnamese toward the Chinese, by modern-day Marxist-Leninist standards in Hanoi, are merely feudal bourgeois sentimentality. It is presumed by the true believer in Hanoi, the party people, that in the early 20th century, with the rise of the Red Brotherhood, linked Chinese and Vietnamese revolutionaries together in a common destiny. Ho Chi Minh and other early Vietnamese communists worked out of Canton in China in the 1920s. They were supported by Mao Zedong more energetically than by Moscow in the Stalin years. The Chinese largely funded the Viet Minh War during its war against the French, and they resumed military aid at the start of the Vietnam War. This was all described at the time as a lip and teeth relationship, but it didn't last. The thousand-year Chinese province ended, but something of an intimate master-pupil, master-sensei relationship lingered on. As late as the 1880s, Vietnam was according symbolic deference to China. The court in Hue, in Hanoi, annually sent a token tribute to the Emperor of China, a single gold coin in a silk-lined lacquer box. This went on year after year until the late 1880s. The spirit of that sense of deference to China still continues, I think. Vietnamese don't really like to acknowledge it, but it is, I think, a true love-hate relationship. They admire the Chinese, but they fear the Chinese. I suppose you could make something of an analogy between Americans and British culture. Even though we fought a revolution with them, we still stole a whole society from them. And so the relationship is more complex than simply fear or hatred. All right, moving on to the colonialism and the French presence. Saigon's main street, Tuza, Freedom Street, formerly was named Catana by the French. It was named after the ship that brought the first of the French to Vietnam. Now it's called Dong Khoi, or General Uprising Street. But this street, in many ways, symbolizes, especially under the name Catana, symbolized France in Vietnam. It ran from, still does, run from the Saigon River docks up to the square dominated by the largest cathedral, Catholic cathedral in Indochina. It's only a few blocks long, a pleasant avenue lined with tamarind trees, full of shops and imported goods and sidewalk cafes and bars and a few nightclubs. It was trade and religion that brought the French to Vietnam, and they left a style of living such as you found around Cuba, and the influence of foreign ideas. They also left a heritage of bitterness and hatred not found in other ex-colonial countries of Asia, even Indonesia. It's a sort of ironic fact because during their sojourn in Indochina, the French prided themselves on their close, unique relations with their colonies, the limbs of the mother country, across the Northern. Rapport, I would say, by most accounts, was closer in Indochina between the French and the Indochinese than it was in other colonial powers in Asia. The economies of the two countries, France and Indochina, were meshed. Indochina manpower, for example, was freely tapped for the mines of France. A doctrine first of assimilation and then of association brought education, dual citizenship, other benefits of French civilization. The wrench, or the breakaway when it came, was thus proportionally greater. In southern Vietnam, there was no great tradition for revolt, as was known by their cousins to the center and the north. The south, of course, did not exist in the days of the Chinese domination. There were no Vietnamese in southern Vietnam at that time. The Vietnamese arrived in the Kamau Peninsula, the far south, not much before the French. They were in the process of gobbling up the Cambodian Empire when in fact, the French came and put a stop to it. And even with a surge of anti-French nationalism, which began in the 1930s, the feeling was stronger of nationalism was stronger in the north and among the centerites than it was in the south. Vietnamese were, this is Virginia Thompson in one of her books, wrote, the Vietnamese were still preoccupied with the Malays, which contact with the West inspired them. They concerned themselves with citing abuses for the French to reform. They did not think of taking matters into their own hands by demanding political rights. This was essentially the attitude that dominated pre-World War I period. Learning, not revolution, was the byword for the great majority before 1914 in the South. Anti-French feelings in Vietnam came in waves after this period, but beginning about 100 years ago. From the very start, when the French arrived in some significance about the time of our Civil War, there was considerable hostility demonstrated by some segments of the society. Most important was called the monarchist movement, Cang Vung, which was a series of military uprisings instigated by the emperor and his court in Quang. Resistance was confined really for the large part by the ruling classes, the mandarins and the educated 10% of the Vietnamese did not involve the masses in this period. Decades later, in about 1900, came the so-called scholars movement. This was a reaction to French suppression of private Vietnamese schools. Schools run by these scholars and have no connection with the French. The French suspected, correctly, that they were centers of anti-French activity. Anti-French teachers organized peasants into mass demonstrations, and not in the name of education, but in the name of tax reduction. Again, the movement saw its greatest impact in central and northern Vietnam and tended to lose its steam in the south. World War I, which altered so much of the world, brought profound change to Indochina, stimulated the economy, value of the piastre, the local currency, rose steadily, as did standard of living. Economically and psychologically, ties with metropolitan France were loosened. hordes of workers were sent to France to work the mines and perform war services. These returned home after the war with money, with a better understanding of the French, the new attitudes toward the white man and colonialism, and a whole series of social attitudinal changes. These village leaders throughout, especially in the South, became prominent, and many of them as a result of having worked in French coal mines. The early years after World War II were fairly quiet. The French allowed the Cochin Chinese, the southern third of the country, greater political and organizational latitude, partly because Cochin China was a colony, a direct appendage of France. In general, the great debate among Vietnamese in the 1920s, that is the 10% or so who thought much about the matter at all, was between independence through militancy or through working greater freedom within the French community. The southern Vietnamese were more inclined toward collaboration. This attitude maintained itself throughout the intervening years. I knew when I was in Vietnam several thoughtful Vietnamese who asserted that the Viet Minh War was what they called a mistake. And they would say, had we, the Vietnamese, displayed a little patience, had we not, particularly Southerners, had we not been led astray by those hot-headed Northerners, the French would eventually have left Vietnam without blood being spilled, as the British left India. That really epitomizes the Southern attitude. I used to say, yeah, the way they left North Africa. Nevertheless, in this period between the two world wars, all Vietnamese, to some extent, were caught up in the fires of nationalism. These nationalistic organizations of all stripes proliferated. There were really three clusters of these during the 20s and the 30s. First, there were the reformists, who favored collaboration within the French community, which was strongest in the South. Second, there were the militants, both the communists and the non-communists, who called themselves the nationalists, who opposed the French and favored to some degree of open warfare. Actually, some of the nationalists were much more bloody-handed than the communists were. And three, those who opposed both collaboration and open revolution, who counseled working obliquely, often suggested working through the Japanese. That had more sex appeal in the 20s and 30s than it did after World War II. But Paris, once the Viet Minh War started, had great difficulty in putting its heart into Indochina and into the war itself. Successive government, French governments demonstrated a singular inability to press the war or the will to victory, to achieve a settlement, or to effect a disengagement. Well, those were sort of the three choices they had, and they didn't seem to want to any of them. An ability to press the war, a will for victory, to achieve a settlement. As for colonialism itself, the star-crossed colonial administration in the colony itself is a kind of relentless, a combination of relentless logic and endless corruption. It's totally unequal to the task it faced. Ingrained in the local bureaucrat, the French fonctionnaire, was the idea that they could enjoy the benefits of power without exercising any of the responsibility. Even in the South, which was more hospitable to the French, no serious effort was ever made to induce the South Vietnamese to remain loyal to France. Quite the opposite, as late as 1949, General Carpentier was able to declare that, quote, they must be taught a lesson they will never forget, indicating in the previous 2.5 years of the Indo-Chinese War had taught him nothing at all. The psychological field then was left to the enemy, to the Viet Minh, and they were able to arm themselves with rational and emotional arguments. finally, to the fourth foundation of Vietnamese history, modernization, often termed the revolution of rising expectations. The modernization process deals with 20th century influences, wars, hot and cold, technological revolution, especially in communication and transportation, growth of regionalism, the Cold War, Sino-Soviet dispute, ideological struggles, economic development, all developments of the 20th century. Any of you ever see the movie Patton, George C. Scott? God damn the 20th century, he says. Well, more on each of these will be discussed throughout the year. The point to be made here is that modern nation building, which was the task of Vietnam, North and South, this is a task which is very lonely. It's one that each country must perform, or society must perform for itself. Outsiders, even if they're so moved, are limited to the contribution they can make. The converse of this is also true. Also, outsiders can do very little to prevent developmental failure. This, as I have termed somewhat facetiously, Pike's third law of Asian politics. Every country is its own worst enemy. No country can do damage to you that you can do to yourself. But in any case, we must acknowledge that the eternal cultural factors, broadly defined, good and bad, are the primary influences at work and not extra-regional influences. However, certain criteria, mostly internal, some of them external, can be set down to serve as a yardstick for measuring the course and the pace of the modernization process. I don't really have the time to go into this here. I will give you a lecture in 17 and 18 later, and in this we'll use the criteria on national development, which was worked out at a MIT Harvard faculty seminar I attended in the early 1960s. It's on page 154A of your reader. You'll find the criteria. 10 tests that are offered for measuring in somewhat objective manner whether a country is moving toward economic, political development or not. Incidentally, any one of those 10 would make a good starting point for a research paper, if you're so inclined. I need a couple of the criteria just for your information. Is national consensus developing with respect to basic social and political goals? Is communication increasing between leaders and led? Is a competitive political system emerging? Are politics being secularized? And that's a question in the Mideast. Is the civilian element in control of the military? And so on. Is there reasonable political mobility? Any one of these would make a subject for a good paper. All right, moving on to part two of this lecture, the three historical influences, or engines of Vietnamese history, beginning with geographical regionalism. Every country in the world knows this phenomenon, geographic regionalism. It's a powerful set of prejudices and stereotypes. Usually it is sort of north and south, as it is in the U.S., or perhaps east and west. Even in smaller systems, you find it. I can remember in Switzerland, in Zurich, hearing Swiss tell me about those rotten southern Swiss, how different they are from we people here in the north. As an outsider, I could absolutely tell no difference whatsoever. In Vietnam, as you might expect, it isn't simply north and south, it's north, center, south. Tonkin, Annam, Cochinchina. Three So the unity that is ingrained in all Vietnamese, their bones really, is not geographic, but it's tribal. And their amazing ability to resist centuries of Chinese political military pressure without being Sinoized, and all the tribes around them were succumbing, and their ability to maintain a national identity despite the internal divisive conflicts and vast geographic distances. All of this has been so impressive as to obscure the real and vital fact of deeply ingrained regional divisiveness. Not to diminish in any way Vietnamese coalescence, but the import and the consequence of the Vietnamese sectionalism must be understood, appreciated in understanding the Vietnam War. Regionalism derived from Vietnam's expansionism of its 800-year, 1,500-mile march to the south, which you'll find in the map. This was a series of leapfrog moves, some voluntary and some forced by the emperor and his court, who would oversee the departure of groups of Vietnamese from the more populous and settled areas and the successive establishment further south of new villages, large enough to be economically viable and physically secure. As I say, it has been likened to the westward movement in the United States. This thrust began in the 10th century when the Li dynasty took the throne from the Chinese and began this a 3.5-century rule. The dynasty's fourth king, Lê Thánh Tông, one of the great heroes of Vietnam, conquered the Champa kingdom to the south of the Cambodian, became the Cambodian in the southern portion of the peninsula. This destroyed its culture, it dispersed its people, and it set the scene for the southern population to move in. The area around Hue in the center was reached in the early 1300s, and all of what was become central Vietnam was settled by the 1400s. After a hiatus, this far south movement began again in the 16th century, 1600, down to what is now known as Phan Thiện, was reached by the end of the 17th century. And present-day Saigon, about in the middle of the early 18th century. And the Mekong Delta to the far region was reached by about 1800. In this process, the Vietnamese were in the process of detaching, really, what country they came to, which was being held by the Cham, a smaller empire, or the Cambodians, the Khmer, Champa is what it's called. Joseph Buttinger, in his very good book, The Smaller Dragon, describes this process. It was a slow advance that lasted over 800 years, carried on primarily by a type of peasant soldiering for which this people, seemed to have developed an aptitude at a very early time. The peasant became a soldier whenever an enemy approached, either for plunder or to drive the Vietnamese from the newly settled territory. Thus, the Vietnamese began to march south, looking for new plains behind every row of mountains, pushing along the narrow flatland between the mountains and the sea, proceeding on water, where the mountains went directly into the ocean, and settling in valley after valley with every new delta as a new base until they finally reached the open spaces of the Mekong Delta. By 1882, Cochin China consisted of 6 provinces and 22,000 square miles and 1.6 million people. But this leapfrog process from the north to the center to the south was part of a longer divisiveness or geographic division of Vietnam. For 300 years, Vietnam was divided into halves or thirds. Half of the secession came in the 1600s and thirds during the reign of the Thế Son brothers. Under the French, the three divisions were established: Tonkin, in the north, Annam in the center, and Cochin China in the south. Cochin China was part of France, regarded technically. It had a ruler who ruled the country, and unlike the center of Vietnam, where the emperor reigned, but he didn't rule. He was standing behind the emperor was a French resident superior who actually was running the place. Annam was, in effect, an indirect protector. Southern China, Cochin China, which is a corruption of Ki Chim, which foreigners pronounced as Cochin to distinguish it from the port of Cochin, which was in India. It was a French possession. It was not even under nominal rule by the Vietnamese emperor. The colonial administrator governed in the south, while the Mandarin remained somewhat more firmly in Annam and Tonkin. Thus, the southerners were more markedly affected by French colonialism than their cousins to the north. After 1954, Vietnam was again divided, this time into halves, with North Vietnam, Tonkin being all north, Annam, central Vietnam, being divided, half being in the north, half being south. 17th parallel is the division. But then, from then on, and right to the present day, I think the important thing is that this north, center, south becomes a reference, particularly by confusing to foreigners when someone says they are from the center, and you don't know, didn't know whether that means the center of North Vietnam or the center of South Vietnam. But it was a geographic division. There was a sense of identification. And I'll say a little more about that in a minute. The point is, I think that this march to the south produced a South Vietnamese who was something of a pioneer, more remote than the settler from the settler pleasures of the north and distant from the venerable city of the emperor in the way. Because the land is more tropical, two seasons instead of four in Hanoi, southerners were, at least in the minds of the northerners, more apt to demonstrate something of a lackadaisical attitude common to peoples of hot climates. Such generalization, a whole series of prejudices and stereotypes and self-images grow up among the North, Center, and South people, particularly when you find them mixed, as in Saigon. You realize these are prejudices or stereotypes, and but you can't really discount them entirely. The Vietnamese love to dispense them. The Southerners are lazy, they're slow-witted. That's what the Northerners say. Or they're boorish and unintellectual. That's what the Centerites say. The Centerites are hidebound or overly traditional, say the Northerners, or vague-speaking, quote, and too political, say the Southerners. And the Northerners are aggressive and warlike, say the Southerners, or money-hungry and overly sharp in business deals, say the Centerites. On the other hand, the Northerner tends to regard himself as dynamic and progressive. The Centerite pictures himself as a cultivated individual, guardian of a treasured cultural legacy, only people that can really understand Vietnamese literature and music. And a Southerner believes that only they have an appreciation for pastoral harmony and for bountiful nature, and are more philosophic and easygoing. Even a foreigner living in a country without being caught up cannot live long without being caught up in this sectional bias. I remember coming to work one Monday morning and with my tutor, my language tutor, going into my office and saying, who is a northerner, saying to my secretary, who's a southerner, what did you do on this weekend? And she said, oh, I went out and I sat on a hill and I thought about nature. And so we go in and close the door. It's tourism, just like a Southern. Sit on a hill and think about nature. That's why this South will never amount to anything. And as I say, but the Southern, it wasn't for those hot-headed Northerners. The French would have left this place like the British did India, and we all of our troubles are traceable to that hot-headed Northerners. As I say, it becomes almost second nature to you if you live in Vietnam a long time. It's sort of the first thing you ask a Vietnamese when you meet him, or did in the old days. Where are you from? Oh, I'm from the center, I'm from the north. In Switzerland, once I called on the South Vietnamese ambassador to Switzerland, and I was taken over by a fellow from the American embassy who obviously couldn't locate Vietnam on a map. And when we went in, I said, I was introduced, how do you do, Mr. Ambassador, where are you from? He said, oh, I'm from the north, why don't you sit down? And this American with me said, what does he mean, he's from the north? The north to him meant North Vietnam. But the point was, it was so natural for me to ask, it's so natural for him to, that neither of us saw anything unusual about it. Anyway, the point is, I think that this regionalism is as important in understanding Vietnam as, say, caste is in India. You can't understand politics or anything in India without always keeping in the back of this fact of caste. Same thing is true of regionalism, the north, center, south. The thing in Vietnam, it's a little easier to tell because if you have only a rudimentary knowledge of the language, you can pick up a northern, center accent instantly, southern. The word yes, for example, is za.